Well, Matt, and welcome to episode 120 of the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for January 31st, 2016. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings, this is Bill Walthall, and in this podcast, we have more than slightly delayed continuance of our discussion of Othello with a look at the major video versions out there for viewing. First, let me start off by saying that I'm sorry that this has taken so long. For those who may have missed the last podcast, I lost my father on December the 10th. The fog of grief is only slowly lifting for me, so part of my healing process over the last couple of weeks have included time with my family over the holidays and a trip back east with my wife to see our son Kyle as he swam in his senior day meet for the York College of Pennsylvania Spartans. If I had pushed through and tried to write during these weeks, I'm not sure the product would be readable. And though I still have doubts now, it's time to get back on the horse and ride. So that said, I've altered the plan a bit. I'll be doing Othello through February and then tackling Lear from March through May. I'll also be skipping two terms of my master's program because I know trying to understand literary criticism with this lingering fog would be less than fruitful, methinks. So, on with the videos, and in the order I watched them. In 1989, Trevor Nunn reteamed with Ian McKellen to take on another tragedy. They had done Macbeth together in the 70s. This time, Othello, with Willard White in the lead role and McKellen as Iago. This Royal Shakespeare Company production included Nunn's soon-to-be wife, Imogen Stubbs as Desdemona, and Zoe Wanamaker as Emilia. This is a dark video reproduction of the play's presentation, and I don't mean tonally, though it is. Visually, it's dark. Set on a plain and often empty stage with only a scene's main prop, a table, some crates, or maybe Desdemona's bed in the final scene lit, and the actors doing their thing around it. In most scenes, the background fades to black. In such a relentlessly tonally dark piece, this visual motif does nothing to generate any interest for the eye. Maybe that was Nunn's point or purpose, but it still doesn't make for a great viewing experience. In some scenes and shots at the beginning and at the end of the play, the character is singularly lit with black surrounding him, cutting him off from connections to the rest of the characters or the world. Again, this doesn't necessarily make for a fun visual experience. The costumes give the feel of a 19th century militaristic society, just modern enough to help bridge the viewer's chasm between his own time and Shakespeare's, but period enough to give it that classic vibe. Interestingly, in her first few scenes, Desdemona wears what seems to be a kind of burqa. The performances are, not surprisingly, excellent. McKellen is awesome, and White is great, though his basso profundo voice is almost ridiculous in its deep richness. That use of a technical term may not be technically correct, but you get my point. Though some will find fault with Michael Grandage's Rodrigo, I found this performance so ridiculously overwrought, even going so far as to throw a tantrum on the ground, that you can see how easy it is for Iago in the beginning, which makes his manipulation of Othello a series of bar raisings. Both Stubbs and Wanamaker make the most out of the wives' roles. Nunn has quite the directorial resume, but I find his work in musicals, Cats, Les Mis, more entertaining than his Shakespeare productions, Twelfth Night, this Othello, at least thus far, that McKellen Macbeth is still in my future. Some of his choices are interesting. Iago's body reading of his compliments of Ophelia before Othello lands in Cyprus. Zoe Wanamaker smoking a pipe coming out of intermission, which comes with the handkerchief dropping to the ground. The passive-aggressive dynamic between her Emilia and Iago. Othello searching under a pillow to find the sword he will use to kill himself. But not everything works, though. Jarring sudden turning to the camera for soliloquies. Unnecessary camera moves. I think this is to try to break from the static set. Slow pace. Othello's physical attack on Iago. An almost stultifyingly reverent tone. Verdict? Good, but not gobsmacking. But still, worth a viewing. In 1995, English actor Oliver Parker made his writing and directorial debut with a version of the play with Laurence Fishburne as Othello and Kenneth Branagh as Iago. coming on the heels of his Henry V and Much Ado About Nothing. This marks the first and only time that Branagh has appeared in a film adaptation of Shakespeare that he didn't direct himself. Because this is a film and not a capture of a stage production, it can be more realistic in its setting. And from the opening shot of Venice canals at night, we get exactly that. The cinematic element also allows for the camera to do some of the storytelling, like I mentioned in my Macbeth review last month. We see a flashback of Othello dining with Brabantio, as Othello tells his tale, and a dialogueless scene of lovemaking between Fishburne's Moor and Irene Jacobs' Desdemona. And where the camera doesn't do the heavy lifting, the film editing does. Iago's turning of Othello in Act 3 is not represented by a single set sequence, but as snippets from different locations. Now, this is very effective. Parker is not afraid to be playful with the script and its editing as well. The opening of the film gives us the leadership scene of Act 1, Scene 3, then we get to the usual beginning of the play. The performances are excellent. Fishburne is strong, as usual, though tinged with insecurities. Branagh makes for an excellent Iago. Jacob's Desdemona is purely innocent. Parker cuts the early Cyprus sequence in which she can show a more worldly, even bawdy side. And Anna Patrick plays Amelia as an almost willing accomplice. Almost willing until she realizes what her husband has done. In the supporting roles, both Nathaniel Parker, the director's brother, as Cassio, and Michael Maloney as Rodrigo acquit themselves well, especially Maloney in a thankless role, one that all too easily can come off as ridiculous. Now, I'm not sure how much Parker deferred to Branagh, but his Iago certainly ratchets up his unlikability. He repeatedly takes money from Rodrigo. While money is mentioned in the text, there's never an explicit exchange of money. He grabs Rodrigo's crotch, stabs Montano himself, nearly rapes Amelia, and literally stabs her in the back. Which brings me to, Parker does some interesting things with the ending of the play. Here, Desdemona is robbed of her final lines, allowing only a knowing look. Yeah, I know. How do you present that death sequel with any real poignancy? I'm not sure. Also, Iago kills Amelia almost as a diversion to allow him to escape. And Iago ultimately succumbs to Othello's wounding of him, dying on the same bed as Desdemona, Amelia, and Othello. Interesting, but I'm not sure all of these succeed. What does succeed, however, is Fishburne, who brings a tortured quality to the role, and his interactions with Iago are heartbreaking to watch. Branagh is the only character given a to-the-camera soliloquy. Othello's few solo speeches are reduced to self-muttering. One can only wonder what impact full soliloquies would have had on our view of Othello. Verdict. This is a very good version. I actually think this is a better experience than the Trevor Nunn production, though the Nunn version may have a better Iago and McKellen, but I think Fishburne makes for the better Moor. It's certainly more cinematic, and it's definitely worth a viewing. 1981, as part of the BBC Complete Works series, producer Jonathan Miller kicked off the fourth season with his own directed version of Othello, with Anthony Hopkins as the Moor and Bob Hoskins as Iago. If I'm not mistaken, this is the last time a television production used a white actor in the role of Othello. Of course, had original producer Cedric Messina had his way, this wouldn't have been an issue. Before production began on the series, Messina had wanted James Earl Jones to play the part, but the only way for the BBC to get a British Actors Equity Union to support an act in the series was to use only British actors. Thus, Jones was out, and Hopkins was in, and quasi-blackface was back. With apologies to Robert Downey Jr. in Tropic Thunder, Hopkins doesn't go full minstrel. Blackface, no. Brownface and swarthy, yeah. Hopkins is no Olivier, but that's a whole other review. Despite the inclusion of the more blackish references, they decide to play up the more Muslim angle here rather than the racial one. Iago too takes a different tact as well. Less evil villain, Hoskins plays him as a really malevolent puck, impish, seemingly enjoying the chaos he causes simply for the enjoyment of the chaos itself. As for Desdemona, the choice of Penelope Wilton is interesting. She was 35 at the time. That's pretty old for young Desdemona. That age makes the dynamic between her character and her father different. It could also make her more worldly. But while that can be supported in the Cyprus harbor scene, more on that in a minute, it's not supported by her disbelief with Amelia when Iago's wife discusses the pragmatism of adultery. For me, though, there was just a disconnect seeing Harriet Jones, former prime minister, in the play. That's a Doctor Who reference, and if that's not enough, she's also in Downton Abbey. Anywho, the production's beautiful to look at. Many of the scenes have a painterly quality to them, with Miller citing El Greco as an inspiration. Sonically, however, one does have to strain. Hopkins uses a halting delivery, maybe trying to give us an oral example of Othello's outsiderness. Hoskins uses a thick Cockney accent, and in the scene where Iago questions Cassio about Bianca, we're put in Othello's place, not able to hear much of what transpires. Needless to say, not all of these choices work. The concept of Othello's fit both works and doesn't. What does work is a tiny, subtle moment. After his "perdition catch my soul" speech, there's a little pause and his eye twitches, subtly starts to roll back as if about to fall into a fit. It's great foreshadowing. It's wonderful. If only the fit itself had shown that sort of restraint. Eyes bulging, mouth foaming. I wasn't sure if he was having a fit or if he had rabies. It returns again as he strangles Desdemona, and it's not much better there. As this is the BBC Complete Works version, costuming was as close to Elizabethan as possible, and the script was cut as little as possible, save for the exclusion of the two clown scenes. These small edits drain the play of any possible humor. Even the possible flirty body scene at the harbor in Cyprus between Iago and Desdemona is played straight, and the lack of many more edits than those make for a long play. It runs longer than 3 hours. This play is slow. I mean, slow. Hopkins' performance is interesting. I wouldn't call it altogether successful. Maybe subconsciously I was a little put off by the brown face. His white man's fro didn't help. Hoskins' Iago too is more interesting than definitive. A cackling psychopath giggling in the dark as he attacks Cassio is one angle to go, I guess, but I'm not sure it works. Not all the choices were bad, though. Like I mentioned before, that "perdition catch my soul" moment is great, and the slow buildup of Othello's violence, from calm restraint early in the play, which in retrospect feels strained, through the loss of calm at the handkerchief moment, to the self-battle at the fit, to the striking out at Desdemona, to finally her murder, is very much earned and is excellent. It just doesn't outweigh all the bad. So, verdict? Good. If you've got the patience and you're a completist or want to see the last, maybe, white Othello or wild Iago, give it a gander. Otherwise, I think you're okay to skip this one, which is shocking given the BBC track record. In 1949, production began under the direction of Orson Welles on his version of the play, starring himself as Othello and Michael McLeamore as Iago. Of course, as with any Wells production post-Magnificent Ambersons, the production was not something you could file under without a hitch. Within days of the starting of shooting, the original producer announced his bankruptcy. Wells began not only to put his own personal capital into the film's budget, but also took additional film roles and used the payment of those jobs to continue the financing of the film. The troubled production lasted over the next 3 years in a series of fits and starts, filming when and where it was possible. This meant that a scene that starts in one location could end in another, or that scenes were shot in locales not originally considered. Amazingly, the film was shot by 5 cinematographers and edited by 4 film directors. Thus, it's surprising that not only is the film visually coherent, but strikingly beautiful. From the shadows of Venice to the vaulted ceilings of a castle in Cyprus to the Turkish baths where Rodrigo meets his end, all of these are exquisitely shot. By the way, that last locale, the Turkish baths, was only used when the costumes didn't arrive in time for shooting, and Wells decided to strip down his cast and shoot regardless. If the visuals are stunning, especially given the circumstances, then it's a little disappointing that the sound's not all that great. Because of less than state-of-the-art sound and dubbing equipment, the synchronization of sound and picture is tenuous at best. While later restorations were able to address visual lack of continuity, the sound was always coming from a corrupt source. According to some critics, this is why Wells himself dubbed the role of Rodrigo, played by Robert Coote. Of course, others feel that this was Wells' plan all along to show the link between Iago's comic dupe, Rodrigo, and Iago's tragic dupe, Othello. If the BBC versions were known for their, at least, attempted fidelity to the text, Wells is known for his playing fast and loose, very fast and loose with the text. He's more than willing to chop the text so that while the slow BBC version runs well over 3 hours, Wells gets the play done in less than half that time, clocking in at a svelte 92 minutes. He's also unafraid to present the audience with an opening card and a narrative voiceover. Think of Olivier's Hamlet here. This narration sets up the conflict, allowing Wells to begin with a more provocative opening line from Iago, "I hate the Moor." This is after, mind you, we see Othello and Desdemona's bodies being carried in a state funeral, and much of Iago and Rodrigo's opening dialogue is actually taken from Act 1, Scene 3. So like I said, fast and loose. With such shortening, it's no surprise that most of Iago's soliloquies are gone. In fact, looking back on it, we really only get one soliloquy, and that's a quasi one, Othello's speech as he enters Desdemona's bedchamber. Though it's a solo speech, I'm not really sure why we call it a soliloquy, especially given the way that Wells shoots the scene and its immediate precedent. It's completely possible that Desdemona isn't asleep and hears all this. Now, Wells is known for his ego, so is it possible that he cut all the soliloquies because Othello really doesn't have that many? The performances are solid, if not mind-blowing. This is another case of a white actor tackling the role, but in this case, because the film was shot in black and white, no pun intended, it didn't seem so obvious a case of blackface. In a sense, I think the goal here was as much the same as the 1981 BBC version, to play up the more Muslim rather than black angle. I wasn't as put off by Wells' use of blackface, which was subtle enough that in the dark scenes, you had to wonder if it was there at all. And he still rocks one hell of a voice, and it thrills the ear to hear him speak the verse. As for Michael McLemore as Iago, he's an unredeemable villain. When he and Rodrigo are calling up to Brabantio in the opening scene, Iago is hidden in the shadows of the gondola in the canal. And while we see his shadow, we see only Rodrigo, giving the impression of his dupe as nothing more than a ventriloquist's dummy. His pure villainy is at Richard III levels. In fact, I was thinking that he was visually modeled on Olivier's Richard, only that this film was made after that one, so I'm wondering if that similarity is more because Olivier's cribbing from Wells than vice versa. Suzanne Clotier's Desdemona is good as well, but it almost feels like all the performances, even Wells, were secondary to the play itself. So, verdict. Good. If you don't mind a certain carefree attitude toward line-by-line fidelity to the text, this is a great film. One from which I think other filmmakers have stolen, like Parker's use of the canals and gondolas, as well as the Iago Othello seduction in an armory. Would I use it as an introduction to the play? Probably not, but I certainly wouldn't leave it out in a survey of the available films. In 1965, when in the midst of a 3-year repertory run at the National Theatre in London, John Dexter's staging of Othello, with Laurence Olivier in the lead and Frank Finlay as Iago, was filmed by Stuart Burge. Now, you'd think that this full-color film with the greatest living Shakespearean actor would merit, you know, a big splashy theatrical release. And you'd be wrong. Instead, it was sent out in roadshow fashion, playing in most cities for only 2 days. A couple of reviews back, I said that Hopkins hadn't gone full minstrel in his portrayal of the Moor for the BBC, calling it merely brownface. The last one I discussed, the Wells one, was more of a grayface one given the cinematography. But this one, oh, this one is full-on blackface. Blackface. Black face, black hand, black arm, black foot, black chest, and not just a little black either. We're talking deep, dark, black, buffed to a sheen. It was ridiculous, but fascinating. Ridiculous and fascinating, too, were Olivier's other choices. A slinky, swaggering glide to his step, one of supreme confidence, fitting for his experience and rank, yet he's somewhat gone to seed, a little fat, perfect for his age. And over the course of the performance, that swagger begins to stagger. His voice, too, is different than anything you've ever heard. Seemingly an accent from no nation in the world, Olivier's Moor is the ultimate outsider. But as wild as these choices are, not all of them work, he's certainly invested in them, almost committed. And I do mean that in an old-school, insane asylum way. Just as invested are the performances of the other actors, including a short bull of a man in Frank Finlay's Iago, and a stunning and surprisingly curvaceous Maggie Smith as Desdemona. Both give standout performances, as does Joyce Redman as Amelia. As I noted before, the film never attained a wide release, and while that may have made for less than stellar box office, it certainly didn't hurt when it came to critics. All four leads won Academy Award nominations, though none won the Oscar. The sets were still stagey, though more realistically rendered, as they would be captured by the camera. They work well on screen. It's probably a smart directorial and budgetary choice, especially if they were already anticipating not a wide release and therefore not a big box office. Other successful choices included having Othello wear, for most of the play, large crosses on necklaces, a symbol of his conversion, which he tears off just before going into a precursor of his epileptic fit, and the use of a hidden blade in his wristlet. It's used as a nice bit of foreshadowing as he's threatening Iago, then he uses it to kill himself. And having him hug Desdemona's limp body as he kills himself is simply genius. Of course, not all the directorial choices work. Having Othello go barefoot in some scenes and seemingly turbaned in others seemed to be just a bit too on the nose for my taste, as were the large and, by what I mean, often too big hand and arm gestures by Olivier. They might have worked well on the stage, but here they just felt overdone, too in our face. That said, the verdict is that this is an incredibly watchable film. The blackface is tough to take, but Olivier's performance, as wild and committed as it is either a work of genius or a train wreck. Regardless, you can't take your eyes off of it. The other performances, too, along with its cultural standing, make it, well, if not a must-see, then at least worth watching. In 1989, as part of what IMDb describes as a TV movie, British, though South African-born actress Janet Suzman made her one and only film, an adaptation of Othello, with South African actor John Connie in the lead and Richard Haddon Hayes as Iago. This was based on her own stage production that ran in apartheid South Africa in 1987. Contemporaneous with the 1989 Trevor Nunn version, this marks one of the first film Othellos that was played by a black actor. Interesting note, when Suzman was a prominent actor on the British stage in the 1960s, she was a member of the Royal Shakespeare Company, where she met the aforementioned Trevor Nunn. The two married in 1969. They divorced in 1986, just a couple of years before each's directorial turn. This is a wonderful production. Connie's Othello is no brute, but a charming, passionate man. We see him as a lover, a storyteller. When he breaks from this into violence, it's a shock. But we're prepared for it by the slow dismantling of his appearance, from fully outfitted and formal, to disheveled, to finally shirtless and almost savage in appearance. If the jealousy that is the center of the play is between three characters, it's obvious why Suzman picked her actors. Both Joanna Weinberg as Desdemona and Neil McCarthy as Cassio are incredibly attractive, both with fair skin and flowing blonde hair, a stark visual contrast to the handsome and darkly black Connie. Moving away from these three, the cast begins to look more and more typical, almost mundane in appearance. Richard Haddon Haynes' Iago is a bald, bearded, and embittered bull of a man. His wife, Amelia, played by Dorothy Gould, is plainer and obviously more put upon than her foil Desdemona, yet not without spirit or her own mind. When a dashing Cassio plays her attention at her arrival in Cyprus, she is obviously uncomfortable, casting glances at her husband, making me wonder if there was something to Iago's stated belief that Cassio might have had an affair with her. In this scene, Cassio too is very physical with Desdemona, allowing Iago's asides to us to be all the more believable. This physicality is pervasive and has a cumulative effect. It's no surprise, then, that of the versions I've seen thus far, this is the most sensual. Othello and Desdemona are physically passionate with one another. She's playful with him, but when he begins to suspect her, his affection takes on a violent quality, one that gives her pause. Bianca and Cassio are obviously in a sexual relationship, lusty and physical. And if I'm not mistaken, Amelia is played as pregnant, though this could be a false appearance created by the period costuming. As I noted, the stage version of this production ran in Johannesburg, South Africa during apartheid, marking the first time a black actor played the role on stage in that country. Needless to say, in a country where interracial marriage had been legal only for the 2 years leading up to the production, this sensuality, especially between Othello and Desdemona, was quite scandalous, causing some audience members to leave and others to send hate mail. Those who walked out missed the great ensemble. Connie, with his more African rather than South African accent, makes for both a visual and aural outsider. Haynes is dynamic as Iago, almost a personification of the devil, but one that makes us his accomplice. Weinberg's Desdemona is at once both innocent and flirtatious. And if these three performances sound excellent, and they are, it's Gould's Amelia that is the standout for me. She is the strongest Amelia that I've seen thus far, and I don't mean strength of the acting performances. I mean her character is strong. Yes, she still wants to please her husband, but not because it's her place to, but because it's what she as a woman wants. And in the late portions of the play, when she begins to understand what is unfolding around her, her anger is what we as an audience are feeling. Does everything Sussman throws at the screen work? No. Some of the freeze frames and video shot inserts are more distracting than helpful. Gould's Amelia, while great, reaches her peak a little too early in that last scene, and it feels slightly overdone, as does Othello's speech over the sleeping Desdemona. The gestures and flourishes that worked with an in-scene listening audience did not play as well over a sleeping Desdemona. And even with all the things I liked about the production, especially the sensuality, there were still moments that felt lifeless, that missed some of that spark, which is a shame. So verdict. This is one you should see. The top four performances, especially that of Gould, are excellent and worth watching. Plus, it's a document of the first time a black actor played the role in South Africa. Of course, it would have been better if the video itself gave us some sort of context or historical discussion, but even without it, this is a solid production. In 2007, Shakespeare's Globe in England produced a version of Othello directed by Wilson Millam and starring Eamon Walker as the Moor and Ian McInerney as Iago. As with most of Shakespeare's Globe's productions, a performance was captured for video release. Since Shakespeare's Globe is a physical recreation of the Second Globe Theatre in London, they make an attempt to stage their productions as they would have appeared in Elizabethan times, complete with musicians, contemporary costumes, and a jig at the end. The plays are presented to an audience of both groundlings and seated members in daylight with the theater open to the sky. And therein lies a problem. On a number of occasions, you can hear jets fly by overhead. There are few cuts in the text. They present the off-cut clown parts, but they do cut much of Iago's praise performance at the harbor in Cyprus before Othello's arrival. Of course, that may have less to do with wanting a cut for time or understanding and the fact that this Iago is more consistently angry than most, and the playful, almost flirtatious moment at the harbor might not fit. Unlike the 1989 Johannesburg version, Walker's Othello is no mere storyteller or lover. He's a warrior, one who is usually powerful, but now powerless, almost enthralled by Zoe Tapper's Desdemona. Meanwhile, Iago, as played by McInerney, is angry, bitter, and troubled, not necessarily by a conscience, but rather by a psychosis, a pathology hinted at but never really revealed. It's an interesting concept, if it was only more fully realized or presented. It's a missed opportunity, I think. They also play Iago as older here, changing his age reference from 4 times 7 years to 6 times 7 years. Lorraine Burrows's Amelia is quicker than most of the other Amelias we've seen to realize what's going on. The way she stares at Iago near the end of Act 4 marks the dawning of her understanding. Her anger, in the final scene, almost feels as if it's directed as much at herself than at Othello or her husband. Sam Crane plays Rodrigo as a comic fool, a callow youth with a false bravado. He's kind of like Much Ado's Claudio, transported from Venice, and then to Cyprus. There are some fine touches here. The interplay between Desdemona and Othello is quite playful in the first half of the play, but when the handkerchief is lost, it becomes a duet of rising anger. Bianca watches Desdemona as she leaves Cassio, fueling the courtesan's jealousy. And we've got one of the better epileptic fits that I've seen. Not all of it works, though. The final scenes fall a bit flat. You have a ridiculous in-the-dark fight sequence that's not in the dark because it's in daylight. Othello's entrance as a turbaned Turk is a bit on the nose, and smothering Desdemona in his arms and killing himself with a crossbow was just a bit overdone. And even with an almost breathlessly fast delivery of much of the dialogue, the play still runs 3 hours. Verdict. Not bad, worth a view, but for me ultimately disappointing. With most of Shakespeare's Globe's productions, I've been blown away. with theirs often becoming one of the favorites that I have for any given play. But while there are some great moments here, and no performances aren't top-notch, this just didn't surprise and astound me, and that kind of surprised and let me down. Well, there you have it. 7 productions, none mind-blowing, none a total failure. From bottom to top, I'll rank and give them a grade. 1981 BBC Complete Works with Anthony Hopkins and Bob Hoskins, directed by Jonathan Miller, C-. The 2007 Shakespeare's Globe Capture, directed by Wilson Millam, with Eamon Walker and Ian McInerney, C. 1965 film of the National Theatre production with Laurence Olivier and Frank Finlay, directed by Stuart Burge, C+. The 1989 Capture of the Royal Shakespeare Company production, directed by Trevor Nunn with Willard White and Ian McKellen, B-. The 1952 film by Orson Welles with Welles and Michael McLemore, B. The 1995 Oliver Parker film with Lawrence Fishburne and Kenneth Branagh, B+. And the 1989 Capture of the South African production with John Connie and Richard Haddon Haynes, directed by Janet Sussman, A-. There are a few more out there, but frankly, I just didn't have time for any others. If you have any other favorites, please let me know in the comments section. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries since our last regular podcast, you've missed out on a lot of stuff, just a boatload of subjects, including A Reluctant Decision, Othello Capsule Review 1989 Trevor Nunn with White and McKellen, Max Samurai, Oxford University Press Shakespeare and Islam, Capsule Movie Review Macbeth 2015, Happy New Year by Janice, Othello Capsule Review 1995, Oliver Parker with Fishburne and Branagh, The Geography of Othello, Teachers Pay Teachers, Othello Capsule Review 1981, BBC Collected Works, Jonathan Miller with Hopkins and Hoskins, A Look Back at Desdemona, Othello Capsule Review 1952, Orson Welles, Passing of the Thin White Duke, OUP Blog, 10 Crisp Facts About Money During Shakespeare's Times, Willful Pictures, How Shakespeare Changed My Life, Othello Capsule Review 1965, Stuart Burge with Olivier and Finlay, 2 Degrees of Othello, Minor Barbara, Florence, Race and Actors, Age-Old Questions, Othello Capsule Review 1989, Sussman with Connie and Haynes, Othello Super Edit, I Hate the More, Othello Capsule Review 2007, Malam with Walker and McInerney, Gimme a Break, Protagonist, Antagonist, Villain, Tragic Hero, About Those Soliloquies, Parts 1 and 2, and Othello's History. So, if you'd like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or become a fan of our Facebook page and our Twitter feed. But remember that those social media outlets are more for Shakespeare news and notes than for discussions of our current play under study. Plus, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. Join us again for our next podcast. We hope to see you then. You've been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for January 31st, 2016. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. And we shall see thee anon.